Welcome to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. Figuring out what aspects of your life really define you isn't easy. There's the people that you have relationships with, there's the culture you come from, and there's the stuff you buy. Your sneakers, your cell phone, your car. A century ago, if you were riding around in a car, you were cutting edge. But a few decades later, a car was kind of meh. They were everywhere. The hot ticket by that time was a seat in an airplane. Airplanes gave Americans a new frontier, and it was a frontier they thought they owned because of the work of the Wright brothers. Plus, to be honest, a seat in an airplane used to be a much cooler thing.
Today's menu includes a fresh fruit salad, a shrimp cocktail, a chocolate nut sundae, and the main course, a double lamb chop, potatoes Parisienne, and Brussels sprouts Delmonico.
Jennifer Van Vleck is here to talk about the era when airplanes defined us. She's the author of Empire of the Air, Aviation and the American Ascendancy, and she's an assistant professor of history at Yale. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
So how did this ability to fly, which at one time was a really novel technology, how do you think that changed how Americans thought about themselves?
Well, it changed the ways that Americans understood the place of the United States in the world, because as a globalizing technology that seemed to literally shrink physical distances, it really made Americans feel that the United States, first of all, could kind of expand anywhere in the world, kind of both commercially and militarily. On the one hand, there was a kind of a notion that this would be beneficial for the United States. But on the other hand, the United States had long been protected by the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans. And so with the invention of flight, there was also some concern that this new technology would actually lead to problems for national security.
Well, and it was also sort of the beginning of people feeling like the world was getting smaller. You know, there's a quote that you have in your book, a great quote from Franklin Roosevelt saying, "Gee, I don't know if people in America are going to be interested in the people in Java, but they're going to have to be because now they're our neighbors."
Exactly. So there was also an increasing awareness of other cultures, and both in the kind of the literal sense of airplanes facilitating the transport of people and goods from other countries to and from the United States. But there was also in media coverage of aviation, which was prevalent during the mid-20th century. I mean, the airplane was just ubiquitous in newspapers, in popular magazines like Life and Time, in Hollywood movies.
New York to London, in the same time that it takes you to go and see a baseball doubleheader. New York to London in 6.5 magic hours. It all goes so fast now, and it's so comfortable that you feel as if you hadn't traveled at all.
And in all of this kind of popular discourse was basically the idea that the airplane was kind of opening the doors of the world to the United States. And so, again, that brought kind of both potential and in some ways peril.
A lot of your research, a lot of this book centers around an airline that's now defunct. I remember it vaguely from my childhood, Pan Am. What was so special about Pan Am? I mean, there's certainly a lot of airlines that have gone out over time. It's a very tough business to be in. Why focus on this particular one?
So first of all, Pan Am was the United States' first international airline. It was founded in 1927. And until the end of World War II in 1945, it held a monopoly on international routes originating in the United States. So okay. For that period of time, it was the only international airlines. And then in the post-war period, even after its monopoly was dismantled, it was still very much the kind of the unofficial flagship carrier of the nation. It had this unparalleled iconic status in American culture, which we can see even today in films like Catch Me If You Can or the ill-fated ABC television series.
I remember
called
that.
Pan Am. Yes,
and which lots was only of on pictures of very glamorous flight attendants,
exactly.
You know, getting on and off planes.
Exactly, and more than any other airline. It just it was just synonymous with that kind of allure and the kind of cosmopolitan glamour that was associated with international air travel at the mid-20th century.
Pan Am also invented luxury in the skies.
And they've never forgotten it. In first class on a transatlantic 747, all is space and privacy.
Pan Am, you can't beat the experience.
When was that time? I mean, was there such a time? Maybe it only exists in our imagination, but that time when people thought of air travel as so glamorous and there was this whole sort of theater and the stewardesses were part of it. If you could get a ticket, you'd be part of it.
Right. So the so-called golden age of air travel is typically thought of as the 1930s through the 1960s. And I think your characterization of it is exactly right, partially because flying, especially international flying, was so prohibitively expensive and airlines were competing with steamships, at least in the international arena. And steamships, of course, were luxury liners and they offered all of these services. So airlines felt that they as well needed to meet that level of service. But, you know, interestingly, even though we now look back on that era nostalgically, in comparison today, when flying is basically no more glamorous than taking a Greyhound bus.
That's right. It seems like just you shuttle them on and you have to get the hordes off now.
Right. And there are absolutely very important differences between then and now. But one of the really interesting and surprising things that I found in my research was that even during the so-called golden age of air travel, passengers complained a lot. So in the late 40s, for example, after World War II, there was a huge boom in air travel, both domestically and internationally. Americans were more prosperous, so they had money to spend. And the war had kind of created this whole infrastructure of airports and, you know, and facilities that could theoretically sustain the passenger boom, but it turned out that they actually couldn't. And so people complained all the time that airports were too crowded, that planes had to circle the airport for up to an hour sometimes before getting clearance to land because the airports just could not handle the volume of traffic. People complained that airports were dirty. So it was really funny to me to kind of, you know, even though on the one hand, air travel definitely did have a kind of glamour that it doesn't now, and airlines offered services routinely, you know, like dinner on China plates and free champagne, and, you know, those kinds of things. At the same time, the experience wasn't always pleasant. And also before the invention of jets, air travel was incredibly noisy and often physically uncomfortable. So I think sometimes, you know, in our nostalgia, we can kind of miss some of the problems that occurred even during that era.
Well, yeah, it sounds like they had delays, too.
Exactly. Exactly.
I want to go back to something that you said, that this one technology, the technology of flight and creating fleets of airplanes, that, it had these sort of knock-on effects in terms of changing the face of cities. I mean, there was construction of airports, transit changed. How do you think aviation changed the face of America?
So toward the end of World War II, there are a lot of articles published in mainstream publications, again, like Life and Time and major newspapers about kind of what the landscape of post-war aviation would look like. And there were some predictions that were serious at the time that look now kind of farcical to us, predictions that major cities like New York would have like 8 or 10 airports and that people would have their own personal planes to basically operate like cars. And of course, none of that really came to pass. But one thing that happened, though, kind of both domestically and internationally, is that air travel increased the significance of places that were previously kind of not major cities or major destinations. So, for example, in the South, in the United States, air travel was a key means through which cities like Atlanta and Houston in the post-war era basically tried to kind of make themselves into global cities. And of course, this is also in conjunction with the kind of the transforming economy of the New South in the post-war period. But by building these very large municipal airports, cities like Houston and Atlanta really made an effort to put themselves on the map of the world in terms of kind of facilitating trade as well as tourist travel. Air travel has changed physical geography in really interesting ways that I think are sometimes not as noticeable as other means of transportation like highways and trains. It's very easy to see how those transform, urban landscapes.
So we've talked about this golden era of aviation. When do you think the golden era, the empire of the air, when did that end? I mean, we talked about Pan Am, which you focus on so much, being no more, of course, along with many other airlines. So what was that moment or that period when things went into decline or just morphed into something else?
So Pan Am and other so-called legacy airlines, such as TWA, experienced a kind of a long, slow decline beginning in the 1970s. And there were a number of reasons for this. First of all, they had invested heavily in jumbo jets and 747s at the end of the 1960s. And by the time these jets were delivered in the early 1970s, there had been the 1973 oil crisis and the recession. So fuel was extremely expensive. People were not flying as much. They were cutting out discretionary travel expenses. And so all of a sudden, Pan Am and these other large airlines were kind of saddled with these enormous fleets of jumbo jets that they couldn't fill with passengers. So that was one thing. And really the final nail in its coffin, which one pilot described as the day the heart of Pan American died, was of course the bombing of Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie, Scotland. Mm-hmm. And I don't necessarily see a direct causal relationship between aerial terrorism in the 1970s and 80s and kind of, you know, the decline of the so-called air empire as I've described it. But certainly flying began to have cultural connotations of danger and insecurity that it didn't have in prior decades. So in terms of how people were thinking about flying and kind of the meanings of flight, certainly the rise of terrorism also played a key role in kind of transforming people's attitudes.
Okay, well, here we are, 100+ years into the history of aviation. When you get on a plane, where do you think this is all going? What do you see? What does history tell you?
You know, it's a really interesting moment, I think, in the history of commercial aviation right now, because we're seeing two parallel trends. On the one hand, airlines within the United States are constantly seeking cost-saving measures. So I feel like every few weeks, there's a story that comes out in the news about how, you know, one airline or another has decided to make its seats even smaller, you know, to pack more passengers.
Right, and like water is not allowed anymore unless you pay 25 cents.
Exactly. And the frequency of flights is often being reduced. And, you know, and again, the experiences for people who fly in coach, for that matter, is increasingly one that isn't very pleasant. But on the other hand, we're also seeing this trend in which luxury flying has really experienced a huge resurgence, particularly with airlines that are operated by very wealthy countries in East Asia and the Middle East, like Singapore Airlines, for example, which offer these incredible first-class accommodations, you know, whole suites with showers and beds.
Right. Well, I see advertisements for this, and I think, first of all, I don't know one person who flies first class anywhere. Although, if they are spending money to create these suites and then they're spending money to run the ads, there's got to be a big enough cadre of people who are willing to pay for this that it's worth it.
Right. And it even extends to airports. Certain international airports are now building passenger lounges whereby first class passengers can essentially just bypass the regular security lines and everything else in the airport. And so it's this very, very class stratified experience, I think, to a much greater degree than ever before in history. So it'll be interesting to see how all of this plays out.
Jennifer Van Vleck is an assistant professor of history at Yale. She's the author of Empire of the Air, Aviation and the American Ascendancy. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
We are now making our descent. I won't be speaking to you again, as we'll be in our landing pattern over London in the next few minutes. It was a pleasure to have you aboard our Jet Clipper. We hope to have you with us again soon. Thank you.